Jimmy Connors got hot at the umpire today. He took it out on poor Miroslav Michir, and Jimbo is now in the finals of the International Tennis Championship. Here's a little sample of Jimmy in action, and I mean in action. Watch him.
You can't tell me a ball that lands over here is good.
Far sideline.
You can't tell me that.
I'm going with the call.
You cannot tell me that. You cannot tell me that you only see half of what's going on out here. You can't tell me that. You're a one-eyed umpire today, Rich. Oh, wake up on the other eye.
Watch Jimmy take some of his best cuts with the racket of the day right there as he's smashing the water bucket around. He saved some of those swings for Miroslav Michir, though. Jimmy gets to this point, and when he cooled off, he had a little fun with the camera doing some commentary. Listen to him here.
I'm getting to the point where I'm feeling a little bit more relaxed. I'm not quite as mad as I was, but I'm coming back, and I'm trying real hard now, so not that I wasn't trying hard before.
Yeah, that's some Chicago TV 1988 Jimmy Connors losing the plot, as he did fairly routinely. The reason we're talking about Jimmy Connors is you would have seen Roger Federer won 100 ATP titles over the weekend. And one of the people who congratulated him was Jimmy Connors, who said, "Welcome to the three-digit club. It's been lonely up here," because Connors is the only man who went past 100. He's on 109, which is a fairly impressive achievement, fairly interesting character. And we got in touch with Luke Jensen, a regular voice on tennis here on the show, and said, "Do you know much about Jimmy Connors?" And Luke said, "You know what? I know him pretty well. We were practice partners." So with that in mind, Luke Jensen, come on in. So you guys trained together?
Yes, I did. So the very first experience with Connors, and of course, he was a huge, you know, I idolized the guy. He was a huge hero of mine. And I got a chance to practice with him. And I was just 17 at the time, one of the better juniors in the U.S. ranks. And he basically came out and was all business. He was notorious for very short but very intense practices. And he was still in the tournament. He had just won the U.S. Open the year before. He's one of the top players. And in my mind, I really thought I could take him. I had a very strong game. He was a lot of power. I was still very fast around the court. And he put one on me. I mean, he was all business. He beat me 6-0. I don't even remember winning points. But there's no socializing. It was a cold-blooded kill. I mean, just annihilated me. And the one thing that always stuck to me, and it was really a difference maker as far as what does a pro do, what does a world number one go through to be the best. And at the net post, after he blanked me 6-0, and all these people around, it's the U.S. Open, and it was a field court, and he used to wear this rubberized like sauna suit above his like t-shirt or something. He took it off, and he's dripping with sweat. Even though he beat me 6-0, the amount of intensity in which he played didn't give me a break, a chance to even move around the court without hitting a winner on me. He takes his shirt off that's soaked, and he starts rinsing it out. And he goes, "Son," he called all the young guys son. He goes, "Son, you know how I judge a good practice?" I said, "No, Mr. Connors, I have no idea. Of course, I'm just reeling from getting smoked 6-0 in front of all these people in New York." He goes, "I judge my practice based on the size of the puddle of sweat I leave after I practice." And he rings it out, and this puddle starts to expand. And he goes, "It's a pretty good practice. Pretty good." And I'm like, "Wow." I mean, you beat someone that bad with the intensity and the purpose. And for me, at 17 years old, I was making a determination. What do I do in my life? Do I go to college? Do I turn pro? What truly does it take to be the best in the world? And I got a front row seat, an actual thrashing from Jimmy Connors, the defending U.S. Open champion, and just showing me what you have to do, what you have to be, the price you have to pay to be number one. And we battled a few more times in practice and in some world team tennis matches that were just thrilling. As he was getting older, I was getting a little older too, and I was starting to come into my prime as he was leaving it. So I can actually say I have a win over Jimmy Connors in world team tennis, was really thrilling to me to have that on my resume and that experience.
Was he a magnanimous loser when you did beat him later on?
No, he was not. He was not happy. I mean, if you run into a true, you know, great, they hate losing more than they like winning. I mean, the thought of losing, the handshake was very impersonal. It wasn't what you see today where the guys come together and they hug and they exchange their jerseys and all that. No, he was mad if he lost a point. He was mad if he lost in anything. And that's what set him apart, to win all those titles, to be such a legendary figure, and to see him, you know, still connected to the game, like with Roger Federer crossing into the three digits, it's just awesome to see that he's still connected to our great game.
So as well as being one of the best players in the history of the game, 8 Grand Slams, 5 US Opens, he never did manage to win the French. And as we've said, over 100 titles across his career. He was world number one for 160 straight weeks in the 1970s, which at that stage had never been done, 160 consecutive weeks. So as well as being this generational player and a phenomenal player, he was, I mean, unorthodox, to put it one way. Tennis had not seen many like him at that stage, the way he dealt with umpires, the way he cussed out opponents, the way he interacted with the crowd. He was the godfather of tennis punk, I was reading in a piece today. Like, he would grab his crotch, he would give people the finger, he simulated sex on the court. By tennis standards in the 1970s, 1980s, he was pretty out there. Can you remember the impact that he had?
Yeah, I mean, my parents would, you know, listen, discipline me if I acted that way. John McEnroe was kind of in his wake. Nastassi, I think Connors learned a lot from Ilie Nastassi. Those three kind of changed the gentleman's game. That was tennis. There weren't really rules. There wasn't time violations and all these things. You just played at a consistent pace. Nastassi, Connors, and McEnroe, in order, changed the game. They created rules and boundaries in which competitors could do certain things. I mean, you can YouTube, I mean, classic Connors, like here at the Westside Tennis Club in Forest Hills during a U.S. Open match on clay. You know, he hits a ball, they challenge the call, so he knows it's the wrong call. They're about to overturn the point that he won. So he runs across the net and like wipes out the mark so he gets to keep the point. I mean, that was unheard of. Like, you would never cross to the other side. He's the only guy in the history of tennis, male or female, to win a U.S. Open on all the surfaces, grass, clay, and hard court.
Yeah.
I mean, the guy did amazing things, but the competitor, I mean, he transformed as the brat. You know, think about it. He wins in 1974 the Wimbledon Championships over Ken Rosewall, and then he makes this run in 1991. Look at that career span, that run in 1991, which is historic at the U.S. Open, didn't win the tournament. But I think he was like 39 years old at the time.
Yeah.
That was incredible.
Yeah, the 91 US Open run is almost, in a weird way, his crowning achievement. I know obviously it's not in kind of concrete terms, but there's a 30 for 30 documentary just about the 91 run. He turned 39 during the tournament. He'd been ranked 174 in the world the year before. He started off beating John McEnroe's brother in the first round, which I'm sure he enjoyed, and went all the way to the semifinals. I think Jim Courier won in straight sets, and Edberg won the tournament. But really, this was Connor's tournament. And so his relationship with fans I'm interested in, because he makes the point that at that stage in his career, you know, he was pretty much beloved, especially by the New York audience and a US Open audience. But early on, fans weren't so sure about him. You know, the crassness was a lot less charming at that stage.
Yeah, because he was fighting. He was a guy from, you know, the other side of the tracks down near St. Louis, Missouri. And he was a kid that was raised by two women, his mom and his grandmother. Dad really wasn't in the picture. And he was raised rough, and he was raised mean. He was a mean competitor. And at first, he took the tennis establishment and really rubbed them the wrong way. He played with a two-hand backhand. No one really had done that before. He really changed that. He used a weird racket, that T2000. And so as he was so brash, that rubbed against the tennis establishment. And then as you spin it forward later on in his career, if you really dig into history, it started on a People's Sunday, a middle Sunday, which is traditionally off at Wimbledon. They had to play during People's Sunday because of all the rain in the first week. And Connors played a historic match. I think it was Derek Ristagno or Michael Pernforce, one of those two. And he learned at that point, Connors understood, instead of going against the crowd, he could use the crowd. He could use the crowd and get them all worked up and fired up about the drama that was taking place between two tennis competitors.
Yeah.
And I think that turned him in to the person people began to love. people started to admire. As he started to get long in the tooth, people started to love the fighter. And that's when you start to see Connors turn to the crowd and get the crowd fired up and get behind him instead of his opponent.
Yeah, Rod Laver said that Connors deliberately put off an opponent because, as much as anything, he could play well in the midst of the turmoil, in the midst of having a massive disagreement with the umpire, in the midst of the crowd losing their minds over whatever storm he created, that he could play well in the midst of all that and it would put off an opponent. And so, like, he wasn't popular with his competitors. So John McEnroe was asked relatively recently why you two clashed, beyond the obvious, beyond being rivals. And McEnroe, sort of laughing, but said, well, besides him being an asshole, you know? So he wasn't popular with his competitors.
No, those two guys, I mean, really, do a 30 and 30 on Connors and McEnroe, yeah. What I call Cain and Abel. They're like kindred spirits. They both have an unbelievable desire to win, and they were just locked into this epic battle and bookends with Borg and Lendl and these other guys. But pretty much those two just were fire-breathing dragons, and it was must-see TV. And to this day, they have a tough time even talking to each other.
Right.
The battles were so personal. You know, McEnroe threw his racket and went on the other side of the net to Connors' side. It wasn't at Connors. Connors took it and threw it to the other side, away from McEnroe. I mean, there was shoving and finger pointing. I mean, tennis had never seen that before. A street fight, a real street fight on center court Wimbledon. Mm. A street fight every time they played, and it just made must-see TV, like eyes on that confrontation. Mm. And I think that enhanced both their legacies.
McEnroe ultimately prevailed with a winning record, 20 versus 13 against Connors. When they were both kind of, whenever they played as close to both being at their best, who was the better player?
Well, it depends on the surface. You know, they're both fast talking, fast playing, very aggressive hitting, first strike Americans. McEnroe, I would give the edge to because he had so many more layers to his game and his genius. Connors was very smart tactically, but didn't have the options. You know, what you really think of McEnroe is a Swiss Army knife of options.
Yeah.
Can do many different things. Like the Federer before what we see in Roger Federer. Can do serve and volley, serve and stay back, all that stuff. Connors was a blunt instrument, a great returner that fed off of, you know, being the counterpuncher. McEnroe was the ultimate attacker, looking for his areas, hitting with the sledgehammer, but also kind of cutting you to death with different angles and touch shots. It was a great matchup of opposites.
Was Connors friendly away from the court, say at a tournament, or if you happened to bump into him? I guess generally you were bumping into him at tournaments, but when he wasn't in match mode, was he in any way friendly?
He was really nice to my brother and I.
Right.
I mean, he was also, I mean, he was, I got a chance to practice a lot with him. But I idolized him. I was never really a threat, to be perfectly honest. I wasn't trying to take his ranking or his rep. But if you talk to Andre Agassi, there was definitely some friction there.
Yeah.
But the Connors with Sampras, or, you know, those guys were taking his legacy.
Mm.
You know, that for a lion like Connors, that was really hard to take. But as far as the guys in the locker room, if you weren't a threat to him, he was always really pleasant. Even to this day, the guy is an ace with sponsorship outings and charity events. He is just so first class. But, man, if you want to get in the ring, you got to make sure you understand you're going in with a lion.
Yeah. Because even from memory, Agassi's book, which is obviously a great read, he talks about playing Connors. And in one of their early matches, Connors beats him. And then when they're in the locker room, Connors makes a point of getting changed and getting into some gym gear to say to Agassi, that was such a light workout for me, I'm going to have to go to the gym now. You know, this is the kind of stuff Connors was up to.
Yeah, well, that's the one thing about tennis. Remember, we don't have separate locker rooms. You're all in all that one cage, and there's so much that goes on, the mental side of the game, how you psych out your opponent, how you get in their head. And he knows Agassi is one of the greatest talents tennis had ever seen.
Mm.
So he wants to make it known. Every time Agassi thinks about Connors, he hesitates, he pauses. I mean, Connors was notorious. McEnroe, all these guys, Lendl, you'd play against Lendl in practice. He'd be trying to take your head off in the warm-up, trying to hit you. So there's always that mental side within the tour because it's eat or be eaten. Mm. You know, you're chasing or you're getting chased. And so with those elite guys, they always want to play those head games.
Is Conor's, so you talked about the extra layers to McEnroe's game. How much talent did Conor's have and how much of it was just grit and hard work and relentlessness and heart? Where, like, in the talent, you know, when we're talking about talent, how talented was Conor's? Yeah.
Well, you know, it's how you break it down, because a lot of people don't view, in my opinion, raw determination. I'm talking want to, where there's a will to go through that brick wall, that fire, that lava, to do whatever it takes to win. He had that. He had that in spades. Mm. And so I believe that's a talent. McEnroe had the hand. He had this God-given talent. He was an artist on the court. Conor's wasn't. Conor's was the raging bull. Mm. He was the guy coming at you. He didn't care. You were the problem. You were the guy in the way, and he was there to knock you out. He was more of a prize fighter. McEnroe was more of the artist, the competitive genius. So they were just a little different.
Yeah. It's interesting you say as well that he was almost one of the first with a two-handed backhand.
Yeah, Chris Sever was in. You know, that was before then. Most, like 99% of the players played with one-handed backhand, you know, on the men's and women's tours. Mm. But then Chrissy came along, Conor's came along, and then honestly changed the game, because you could no longer serve to the backhand. It was going to be a slice or a chip that would float. Conor's was that great driver of the backhand. Just could hit dimes on the court, hit the lines, and he was so precise and so very powerful.
Somebody makes the point, Jimmy Connors holds the record of ATP titles, but how many of them were minor ones in the grand scheme of ATP titles? Federer, amazing. He's still winning big titles at the grand old age of 37. He's king of the court. How does Connors' 109 titles stack up compared to Federer's?
Tennis has a lot of potholes in its past. You know, when you talk about Connors never won the French, they really didn't play the French. There was no money.
Yeah.
People really didn't play the Australian Open because at that time there's no money. You got to travel halfway around the world, and it's during Christmas.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not going to leave your family to go on bad grass in Kooyang, where they used to play the Australian, and it's summer down there, it's winter, you have no outdoor practice if you're in the up north on the other side of the world. So it just, the Grand Slam number, you know, how many of Grand Slams would, you know, Pancho Gonzalez would have won, or if we'd have played the full calendar the way they do now, all the rest they have now, all the money that's in the game. To me, the records are the records. Mm. You know, in your generation, for Jimmy Connors, in his lifespan of tennis, where does he stack up? And he is elite, premier. And the same with Roger and Djokovic. You know, those numbers are the numbers, and you have to play your contemporaries, and you can make that argument. I believe Connors set the tone for what I call rock and roll tennis. Guys like myself who looked at American football and maybe basketball to play, instead we saw tennis as cool. It wasn't a private club deal. It wasn't for, you know, people with money. It could be from kids like Jimmy Connors who came from the public parks. Mm. And it gave me a vision that, man, I could see the world and make some money at it. And he made it cool. Like, Connors and McEnroe made tennis really cool. Borg made it cool.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Do you think Connors had a bit of a chip in his shoulder about the private, money-rich types who were playing tennis at that stage?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you know what? You can't take that mad dog mean out of him. You know, he lives in Santa Barbara now. He has a beautiful life with a beautiful wife, two beautiful kids. I mean, life has blessed Jimmy Connors, but he earned it. No one gave him anything. And so I believe that those deep emotional scars, you know, early on, those lessons learned, really has served him well as a great champion. Of course, not the most beloved champion, that you'd have to go with Rod Laver or Roger Federer, who's that way. But it's Connors. I mean, if you're saying, okay, one tennis match for the fate of the planet, man, Connors is probably top of that list.
Yeah. Listen, fascinating stuff as ever. Any other, do you bump into him these days? Is he happy enough without the thrill of competition?
He's had a couple of new hits, so he has replacement parts now. He's happy that he's not in pain walking around. He'll go on the court, but he won't compete much anymore. You'll see some, you know, exhibitions and charity things, but the main thing is that he can contribute just a wealth of knowledge to the young players. He had a stint with Maria Sharapova, a stint with Andy Roddick. I believe there's a player out there that could really use his services. A young talent that's trying to corral the emotions and trying to find out, how do I win a Grand Slam? How do I get the most out of my competitive character? And I think Connors just would love to work with someone like that.
Yeah. Nick Kyrgios jumps to mind.
Nick Kyrgios. Well, I think Kyrgios could use a little Johnny Mac, to be perfectly honest. You know, the delicate genius.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's very interesting how these legends fit with the current stars. But Connors is playing a lot of golf, and I mean, it's still, every time I'm around him, I learn something.
Really? Yeah. Okay. Listen, thanks so much for that. And again, we're talking to Luke Jensen, the man who beat Jimmy Connors. Let's make no mistake, Luke.
Oh, don't say that. He's going to come looking for me.
Yeah. Great to talk to you as always. Thanks a million.
Big Joe, you're the best.
Off the ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.